You're listening to Rosie Cole's Vaudeville Broadcast. This program may contain adult content, so if you're under 18, please either get permission or switch it off. Hello, cabaret fans. Today I am here with the incomparable Ruby Jones. Hello, Ruby.
Hello.
So great to finally get to talk to you on this podcast. I'm so excited. So, for anyone who hasn't seen you,
yes,
it would probably be difficult to find people who haven't seen you. You do so much. It's so great. True. But for people who don't know what you do, yeah, what's your style? What do you get up to on the cabaret circuit?
Well, I'm kind of actually, I think, more of a performance artist, moonlighting as a neo-burlesque, queerless, cabaret, compere situation. I've created this persona, Ruby Jones, in cabaret world, and she allows me to move in lots of different environments. So that's in cabaret, that's in burlesque, that's in fetish or erotica. It's been really amazing. Yeah. But always feel a bit like, I wonder if I'm going to get caught.
It's so funny. I was talking to Michael Twaits about that, and yeah, he was saying whenever he's in one genre, he feels like he's the other thing.
Yeah, definitely.
And it doesn't matter, like, when he's in, like, actor world, he feels like a cabaret performer. And yeah, then when he's in cabaret world, he feels like an actor, and he never really knows.
It's like the intrinsic performer thing of no matter how confident you are, there's probably, like, at least 1% of you that's just never sure.
Yeah.
Like, is this okay? Am I okay? Is all okay? Like, there's always that, like, tiny, tiny bit.
Yeah, imposter syndrome.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think probably, like, 90% of people everywhere are like, when are they going to find out?
Yeah, definitely.
When are they going to find out I'm not what I say I am?
Yeah, so far, so good.
Yeah, nice. So obviously, the incredible multi-talented and multidisciplinary performance artist that is Ruby Jones didn't mm-hmm. just spring fully formed one day.
No.
Where did you start with performance?
Well, from a very young age, I practiced entirely separately, which is a bit strange, acting, singing, and dancing. So I was in choirs and I studied voice. I did different dance things and was a competitive dancer. And then I was in theater and I did straight plays. And then when I was 16, I did my first musical. I played Zanita in The Music Man. And I didn't super love it because it was a bit cheese. But, you know, I did enjoy the aspect of being able to, like, sing and dance and all that stuff. I love musicals, don't get me wrong, super love them. And then when it came to going to college after high school, I'm from Canada, and I was applying to different places in Toronto. And I applied to all these theater schools, so for straight acting. And I applied to the only music theater program that's affiliated with a college or university in Canada. It was my final, like, uni audition, basically. And I was in the middle of a very intensive dance audition because it was, again, it was the only music theater program in the country that had a university or a college attached to it. Otherwise, it was, like, private schools. I don't know why that is, but it made it super competitive. Like, 600 girls auditioned the year that I got into the program.
Whoa.
Yeah, like, and they're, you know, I was meeting people from all over Canada, which is, you know, second largest place in the world.
Oh,
just flying in for this program because it had such an amazing reputation.
Yeah.
And so all of the auditions were, like, super intensive, and so the dance audition itself was over an hour long. Yeah, and there was people who were, like, Shakespearean actors who hadn't done anything, and then there was literally some of the best dancers in Canada. It was amazing. And I was there, and I really love to be challenged, and I've always loved to be physically challenged. And I was being pushed so hard by these dance teachers, but I was really enjoying it so much, and I just thought, I can't stop doing this, the dancing specifically. I really can't stop doing this. But I really didn't want to go to school for music theater. I really didn't want to. But then I just, in the end, the dance kind of won, and I was really lucky to be accepted. There was 30 girls accepted that year.
30 out of 600 applicants.
Yeah, and I was very lucky to be accepted. And to be honest, I think one of the reasons I was I had all this, like, really specific focus separately. So I was already, because their aim was to produce triple threats, actors, singers, dancers. And I was kind of a triple threat going in already.
Yeah.
So I think I was very lucky in that way. Because then on the other side of it, there were people who are like just incredible actors, people who are off the chart singers, like some of the most amazing voices, and then some of the best dancers. And I felt like, well, I'm not the best at everything, but I'm here.
Yeah, but if you're pretty good at all of them.
Yeah, I was very lucky. I was very, very lucky. And also, I didn't have any ego about being around people who were better than me. It was like a chance to learn from the teachers, but also watch these other people like, wow, she's really good at those triple pirouettes. What is she doing that I'm not doing?
Yeah.
And so I got pushed by my peers as well as my like absolutely incredible faculty.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really, really good. I hated it at the time because it was so hard. And like we did, I can't remember if it was in... He was in second year, like we were doing a minimum of 60 hours a week of school and training, and that didn't include any homework, that didn't include any, you know, rehearsal preparing for your scene study course or your dance critique or whatever else. They pushed us incredibly hard, and
it's like 10 hours a day, 6 days a week.
Yeah, it was insane. It was literally crazy, and like when I look back on that, I couldn't do that at my age. I just don't know.
It's where they get them young.
Yeah, exactly. We were all really young, really. And I didn't have much of a social life, and that was my choice. But that also kept me sane and in the program and being, you know, the best that I could be. And yeah, it was really amazing. Again, like at the time, I was like, oh my God, this is crazy. But, you know, I worked with some of the top people, like faculty-wise, some of the top people in Canada and in North America. I think our class started with 45 people, and I think like 32 graduated. Yeah.
You hear that about a lot of intense schools, that people either can't handle the pressure or get kicked off because they're not working hard enough.
Yeah, and also it's like the first day the overall director of the program, he sat us all down and said, like, I've got two things to tell you. And he was like, number one, some of you won't make it past Christmas. We call you Christmas graduates. You will realize that this is not for you. And if you can't put the work into this, then this industry is not for you. This career is not for you. Number two, cocaine is one hell of a drug. I don't want to see you do the most amazing sky flying performance and realize that you were hopped up on cocaine. People will try to sell you cocaine. Like this whole like thing about cocaine. And I'm literally like,
I smoke weed sometimes. Like literally, I was like, is that okay?
It was crazy. Yeah.
So how long was the course? 3 years?
It was 3 years. Yeah.
Three, and that intense all through the 3 years.
Yeah, because that's the thing I'm trying to remember. Like, the thing was, in second and third year, I think third year probably would have been slightly more hours because you were in more productions. But we did school Monday to Saturday, and that's why it was that extra thing. But we were also, the program was totally separate from the rest of the university. Like, everyone else was having Freshers Week, and we were having, like, day one. Like, this is school. Whoa. We were entirely separate, which was really weird. Made us in this, like, really, like, bubble, which is what, though, being in any industry, whether you're an actor or, like, a session singer or whatever, that's what it's actually like. Like, you don't actually know many people, I think, until you get to a certain age outside of your industry. Like, you want to. You want to know what normal people do. You want to talk about normal stuff, but you just can't.
Yeah.
You just don't have time with it. You live with a bunch of cabaret performers, and, like, you eat, sleep, and breathe cabaret. And in this way, it was eat, sleeping, and breathing music theater.
Mm.
Yeah. It was really good, though. Again, it was crazy. And,
Sounds like such an intense experience.
So intense.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
But I guess that must have given you a really good prep for the industry.
Definitely.
In terms of people out there actively. Because you don't necessarily feel that when you're in the industry. But if you're in a school, you can, like, feel people actively trying to, like, push you down.
Yeah.
Whereas in the industry, I think it's a little bit more covert and subtle. You don't get to see it, especially now with, like, email. You know, you don't see people face-to-face so much.
Yeah, but totally. But I think in that way, I feel like... I know I am a mentor, and people in the industry consider me a mentor, would give me that title, and I don't take it lightly, and I specifically seek out people I can see in some ways aren't being, you know, pushed and encouraged in that way. Like, for instance, Scarlett O'Hara is one of my proteges or students, or I call
so cool.
Young feminist whores. Yeah, she's really cool, Scarlett, and I can't remember how it happened in my brain now, but she was doing the cheek of it, which is an amazing opportunity for different people to try burlesque and be exposed to burlesque, and for some people to just, you know, feel good in their body, and other people to kind of like dip their toe in like the burlesque waters kind of thing. And Scarlett had done the program, and I knew she was a contemporary dancer, and then I saw her like end of term piece, and I was just like, what was that? Like, not, and I say this all the time on stage, like, to needle Scarlett, so this is not, that sounds a bit harsh, but I was like, what the fuck was that? Because, like, I know she had all these amazing skills, but none of it was being allowed to be applied to her burlesque.
Yeah.
And I just thought, well, that's a damn shame.
Yeah.
And also kind of comes from my roots of being in burlesque, and, like, initially everything I saw was classic. And, or neoclassic, as I refer to most of it, to be honest. And it was like, well, how do I fit in here? How do I, and it was like, oh, actually I don't fit. I'm just going to smash my own space in it.
Yeah.
And make, you know, what I do a thing that is happening.
Yeah.
And so I, you know, Scarlett's one that comes to my mind of me thinking like, you don't have to fit in any box. You don't have to do that. Just do what you do. Yeah. Maybe put a bit more bling on it.
Yeah.
Or don't, you know, not always necessary. And, like, yeah, the scene really allows for that. That's why I love the cabaret scene. It's this amazing umbrella of really being able to do whatever you want. Yeah. As long as it's, you know, I think really thoughtful and considered, and it involves skill and rehearsal and costume and all that stuff. Like, it all has to be considered.
Yeah.
But otherwise, pretty much anything fucking goes.
Yeah. You put the work in. Yeah. And if it's good.
Yeah.
People will like it.
Yeah, and I think when it's genuine as well to who you are and who your artistic identity is.
So when you graduated,
yeah,
from this incredible, intense, hot house of talent and, yeah, extreme training and creativity,
yes,
what did you do? What was your... Well, did you have a plan, or was it just like, oh crap, I've graduated, where am I going?
Well, it was kind of like, I got offered some shows right away. In Canada, there's a big thing known as summer stock, which is, like, summer residencies. Like, people go to their cottage for the summer, but then there'll be, like, a local professional theater company, basically, that produce shows. And it's a huge industry in... It's kind of like our panto, but in the summertime, basically. Mm. We don't really do pantos. We'll do, like, a Christmas show, but not a panto.
Maybe Canada needs
maybe panto. Yeah. I could be wrong. It could be pantos galore now, for all I know. But, so it's basically like summertime panto. There's tons of it, huge industry for it. Most performers want to work in summer stock because it's a good gig, and it's like you, in some, you'll work in rep and do like several different productions, across a season. It's a whole separate season. It's amazing. But I did, I can't remember if it was two or three shows in a row, including one in the Toronto Fringe Festival, Theatre Fringe Festival, which was amazing. And then I got offered a national children's tour, which went across Canada, which was an amazing opportunity. Well, sort of. The production company ended up being a nightmare, which I don't mind saying. Oh, no. It was hideous. But it was an amazing opportunity to see Canada, because at the time of accepting it, I'd done the summer stock stuff, and I'd done like one other production, I did the Fringe, and there's another production which is slipping my mind right now. And I just could see my whole life in front of me. Like, I'll do this, and then I'll do that, and then next summer I'll do this, and then hopefully I'll get that, and I don't know if I could get it that year, I'll probably get it with the next 2 years, and then that's my whole fucking life. And I could not handle that. It felt really, just not me, really restrictive,
it's like career by numbers.
Yeah, and for some people, that is perfect, because they want to have kids and they want to like settle down and they want to still be able to work in the industry, and like that would really work for some people, and for me, just not. So I considered going to the States, but that's a whole kit caboodle with the visa. But my mum's British, so I have a British passport.
Oh, nice. Oh, dual passport, buddy. My mum's American.
Yay!
Two passports rocks.
Totally
so
rocks.
So good.
It's a whole other world. It's a whole other world. And that made it so I didn't have to go and like fight or pay like 10 grand to get this US visa or whatever. And so I came to England before I even graduated college, and I auditioned for actually an agent here and did some different classes and all that kind of stuff, and actually got taken on by the agent. He said if I moved here, he would take me on. And he was a really good West End agent, but also did, like, some commercially type things as well. So still kind of in that vein, because I just had, like, 3 years of, like, bashing music theater in my brain. And I did like it as well. And, yeah, so then I made the choice before I got the tour that if I got the tour, I would move to England and I would pursue theater. And so I got the tour, and that was great because I always felt like, well, I really shouldn't leave Canada until I've seen most of Canada. Like, and I saw so much of Canada in such a short time. In the winter, I was like in places, like there's a city called Regina where it was like minus 35 degrees. I get out of the tour bus and like tour bus, I say like oversized van, and like breathe in and my nostrils would freeze together. Like, it was so cold. It was crazy. And so, yeah, I did all that and just, like, schlepped it. And then I was like, I fucking hate Canada. And then...
You saw so much of Canada, you hated it.
So much. It was, like, this crash course. And it was like, wow, it's an amazing country. Like, mountains and this. And I just want to get the fuck out of here. So, yeah, that was all while I was doing a children's tour as well, which was crazy as well. Oh. So that was great and fine. But then I was like, I'm getting the fuck out of Dodge. So I moved to London. And then I started doing music theater and auditioning for music theater and doing different dance classes and all that kind of stuff. I also worked as an agent for my first year here as well, which really gave me like a kind of crash course into the London commercial scene, whether that was theater or commercials or photographic work or whatever. I kind of got like a real understanding, and I do have quite a business head sometimes. So that really like appealed to that side of my personality. And
how
so,
did you get that job?
Oh my god, so random. So when I moved to London, I knew, and when I say knew, I'm doing like air quotes, I knew three people. So I knew my mum's like friend from business, his name was Mark, and then his late wife, Margot, who her brother owned the agency and was the agent I got the audition with. Right. So that was even how I even got to audition for an agency, basically, as well. Like, in that, it was like a really lucky thing of being able to do that. So I was really blessed in that way. But then 2 weeks before I moved to London, he just suddenly passed away. And so I knew then two people in London. And I was just like, and my person who was a bit of my security, i.e. my agent, has just passed away. And I was just like, blah, I'm still moving. Like, there's no stopping now. And so Mark and Margot had really nicely found somewhere like where I could room and pay like £10 a day, basically, just for the first, like, while I was finding a flat. So I had like basically 2 weeks to sort myself out a little bit in the city I'd been in for like 3 days previously. And so I landed, I dropped my stuff off at the place because it was a hovel. And then I literally went right into the agency office and was like, hi, basically, do I have any castings? Like, hi, one person I know, because Margot had gone in to work in the agency to cover her brother. And that was like a really hard time. And she was obviously incredibly swamped, not just with taking on an agency, but she had a young child and her brother just passed away.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So she offered me a job. So I had a job in London within my first like 3 hours of being here.
Whoa. And just because she needed so much help with the agency.
She just needed someone, basically. And there I was, like, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, like, what can I do? Like, need anything? So she offered it to me, and I was like, yeah, sure. So I was, you know, there, and that's what I did. And actually, you know, I ended up being the head of the agency within 6 months. I was, like, not even doing that much performance-based stuff. I was just really, like, running all that side of it and really enjoying it but also hating it at the same time. But you know, I lived in a flat in Piccadilly Circus, and that was kind of like part of my wages was I lived in this flat for free in Piccadilly Circus, which was beautiful, one bedroom flat overlooking Christie's auction house. Like, whoa. I was like, but I was so miserable, I couldn't even appreciate it. Like, I just knew no one. I wasn't doing anything I wanted to do. I was just like sad in my like gorgeous apartment, which is like tiniest violins playing for me. So yeah, after doing that for about 8 or 9 months, I was like, okay, you've got a couple more months of me, and then I've just really gotta just do something else.
Yeah.
And that's actually when I stopped pursuing music theater, because in that time I had got really close in several roles on the West End, like top three or top five, and it was like for like Sister Act and Sound of Music and shit like that. And it was when I did Sister Act, because that was a brand new musical as well. And, you know, I went into the audition, it was between me and two other girls for one of the characters. I can't remember their name, but it's like, you know how in the film Whoopi Goldberg has those two girls in her girl band? I was going to be one of the girls in the girl band. And then, so once that scene was over, basically, then I'd be a nun for the rest of the show, which, you know, might have been okay. But
I'm there just trying to picture you as a nun.
I know. And I don't even get to, like, rip it off at the end.
Yeah, I was like, yeah, as a it could quirky work that way. Act thing, but as a nun?
Yeah, no, not so much. And it's like, I'm there with a panel, like, 12 people flown over from the U.S., who care so much about this show and so much about this production. And I was auditioning kind of like just hoping I could get it for like the sake of getting it. Like, okay, then I'll have like a job. I was saw it as a job. And then that's when I was like, you know what? I need a little shift. So somewhere in me told me that I needed to remove myself and more specifically like my image, like my physical presence from performing. And that's actually when I started doing what is my day job now, voiceovers. Because I had a client in the agency who did a lot of voiceovers, and he did say to me at one point in time, like, have you ever considered this? Because your voice is a little bit nuts. I was like, no. No, I don't know what you're talking about. Like, kind of like, yeah, and my accent was really thick then as well. And, yeah, it just was like, no. And then just recorded a reel and kind of gave it a go. Because I've got a North American accent, I was a bit of a niche. So, you know, was really lucky that that ball kind of started rolling pretty quickly. You know, just with small things, but I think my energy really lends itself to studio. Like, I right away was doing video games and, like, cartoony type stuff.
Yeah.
Which is really cool. So I took myself away from performance live and focused on performance in a box where, like cabaret, very unlimited. The only thing that limits me is my skill. I can be a 9-year-old boy. I can be an 80-year-old woman. I can be a talking wardrobe or a something, like anything. I could be anything. Yeah. And it just comes down to what I can produce. And I really love that about voiceover. I always have, and I feel really lucky every time I work in it, because it's just
really creative.
Yeah, it's really creative. Obviously, it's a commercial industry, so it has its limitations, i.e., you know, people do judge your or like decide your characters based on how you look sometimes, which sounds insane because you're like,
but it's just my voice. Yeah.
Like, I don't understand why that matters, but okay. So, you know, you have to compete with that to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's also because I'm young and I haven't established myself as well as much. Like, it's like a lifelong industry. And that's the way I look at it. So that's what I started doing once I stopped doing the agent stuff. And that's actually when I started developing Ruby Jones.
Through voice.
Through voice, but also through blogging. So I went through this kind of real personal shift of, who am I? What do I want to do? Like, how do I want to present myself? Who am I? Like, this big kind of
quarter-life crisis.
Yeah, big quarter-life crisis. Like, my Saturn had returned. I was kind of midway between the next transit, and it was just like, what am I doing? And so I started anonymously blogging, and it was really erotic, really like hectic kind of stream of consciousness, all caps, no punctuation, just like streams of whatever came out of me, basically. And then I really enjoyed that, and that developed into writing erotica, and then developed into like going to different events, so kind of covering that more like as a journalist. Then I needed a name, and that's where Ruby Jones started to evolve that little bit more.
That's quite a journey.
Strange chain of events, like, now.
Yeah, kind of. It like it all makes sense.
It does now. Like the thing is, like, I somewhere along the way had like must have had the faith that this was all right, and it was all for a reason, basically.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, it did work out pretty well.
But it's good that you had the sense of self-preservation to be like, this part of the industry is not right for me, and neither is this part, so I need to take some time out and refocus.
Yeah, because I think as performers, like, we feel pressure to say yes all the time. And I started making a real effort to say no. Like, to really go, actually, thank you so much for this West End contract. It sounds super cool, but I'm not totally into it. Yeah. Whereas some actors are like, you did what?
Yeah.
And it's like, I know, that seems a bit whatever, but I didn't want to be ungrateful by doing something I wasn't going to be happy doing. I know that there's someone who would literally, like, sell their child to do a part on the West End. I'm not that person.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that did take, you know, some soul searching, and I was really lucky to have a good connection with myself and my own kind of, like, inner dialogue to know that and to have faith in that decision, because it wasn't, like, as easy as I'm making it sound now, like, oh, okay, nah, I'm good. No thanks. But it was a real thing of, like, no, I have to stick to my guns here. I have to be true to myself, and that's not who I am. 8 shows a week, same show, same role. Not like that. That's not who I am.
Yeah.
Thing is, in that time, I really understood that being a performer is not a choice for me. It is who I am. And I could never get away from it. I just had to embrace it. And I just had to embrace, you know, whatever that meant, wherever I was inclined to go. And not feel pressure to do or be anyone or any kind of artist or any kind of person in the industry, just to be who I am, which again sounds a bit like cheesy or like no-brainery, but like that was a eureka of like, I am a performer.
Yeah.
This is not a choice. Like, it's a choice, but it's also not. Yeah. This is who I am.
But it's, I think so many people do go through their lives and like they don't know who they are. They don't know what they mm-hmm. really want.
Yeah.
Know, there are people who are like figuring it out, you know,
yeah,
for 20 years, 30 years, and they don't figure it out for a really long time.
Yeah.
So to have that presence of mind and that ability to be like, you know what, I need to work this out now, and
yeah,
I need to like be true to that person.
Yeah.
It takes a really strong amount of willpower.
Yeah, I'm very willful, I think.
Yeah. You have to be in this industry.
Yeah, exactly.
You wouldn't need to be a Christmas graduate otherwise.
No way. That was not happening.
So, okay. So this is the good stuff. I'm really excited to talk about this next bit. So you said you started writing about erotica.
Yes.
Have you always been quite interested in the more, like, sexual side of things? Or is this a part of the sort of awakening of being true to who you are?
Yeah, part of the awakening. I think I was repressed, definitely, in that area. I wasn't. It's really strange. But basically, I went through a period of celibacy. Like, I chose, I'm going to be celibate, and I am going to very specifically focus on my own sensuality. And that was actually ran, like, right along with development of Ruby Jones. So in that time, I was teaching dance to kids, and I was doing voiceover. So, like, that was kind of my money was covered. And I actually had quite a lot of me time if I wanted it. I still didn't know a lot of people in London. I'm a bit of a Scorpio in that way. And, like, I'm, you know, I actually have, like, 3 actual friends. Like, you know, I've got, like, I know 3 million people, but I've got 3 actual friends. And that was the thing, is because I didn't have, like, oodles of friends. I had, if I wanted, because the people who were my friends understood me, I just had, you know, whatever time I wanted for myself. And so I was really focused on, like, you know, I'd spend, like, days just, like, masturbating, basically. Like, nice. I need to do this. It is research. But, you know, in the time of understanding that, I read a lot of books. Like, I always recommend Sex for One by Betty Dodson,
mm-hmm.
which is basically, like, saying about how you can make love to yourself as understanding before you make love to other people. And that was the thing as well, is like I'd had 2 boyfriends and I'd had sex with both of them and I hadn't had any orgasms and I just couldn't understand like why that was a thing, but also I didn't want to live my life like that basically. Like I was like, I don't want to be a non-orgasmic person. Like I should be able to learn this. I just need to apply myself.
So sad, wouldn't it?
There's so many people and it's like no judgment because I feel like we're not encouraged to know about ourselves like that. We're not encouraged to...
Well, particularly women aren't.
Yeah, very, very much so. And the thing is like, poor men also, like, they just think it's so easy. And I'm like, you're losing out on so much cool opportunities and sensual depth by thinking that's all that it is. You better, I digress. So in that time, it was like, not just focusing on my orgasm, but, you know, learning about, like, falling in love with my body. I did a lot of yoga. I, like, was naked a lot. Like, I took a lot of selfies, but of my whole body. I did, like, tons of writing, and that's, again, the blog then started, rather than me, like, screaming in caps that my blog was, it started to evolve into, like, full sentences, and it was, like, full thoughts, and it was kind of developed that way. But in that time as well, that's when I first went to cabaret shows and saw people expressing, I don't think, like, burlesque is necessarily intrinsically sexual or sensual, but also I do, for me. So I was seeing this kind of presentation of sexuality and of body and of point of view and feeling okay with that, whereas perhaps in the past I might have been like, oh, why are they doing that? Like, I might have been a bit judgy about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was the shift? I'm so interested in this because I definitely think this conversation does not happen enough.
Yeah.
In society in general.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Sex ed is atrocious.
Yeah, it's so bad. It's horrible. It's
horrendous.
The shift came... One of them, okay, so I think it was probably something that evolved over time and, like, did come out of me realizing, like, wow, I'm having sex with someone and I'm really not enjoying it. What's that all about? Like,
that's... supposed to be amazing.
Yeah, it's supposed to be amazing. And, yeah, and I'm kind of bored of faking like it's amazing now. Like, I need to, like, actually figure that out a little bit. It's a pressure we all feel, and it's a conversation that doesn't happen because there's a strange... understanding or thinking that we should know how to do sex, like, because it's almost like a thing something that everybody does or almost everybody does and is something that's quote natural or whatever. It's like we're supposed to know how to do it, how to do it at all, how to do it well, how to achieve this, how to do that. And it's like, well, why should you just know how to do that? Yeah, you know how to breathe, but that's not the same as this. Like, you know, same as we know we need to eat things, but lots of people don't know how to feed themselves well.
Yeah.
Lots of people don't know about actual nutrition. They just know, like, food in mouth. Like, yeah. That's what I need to do. And it's like, again, that's, like, I think... as far as Western culture goes, we don't, like, we've got this, like, strange disconnect from our bodies, and that comes in, like, eating, that comes in feeding ourselves in different ways, basically.
And movement as well.
Yeah.
So many people, you know, they think, oh, I'll just do some exercise and I will be fit, but then, yeah. Like, people injure themselves, mm-hmm. or they don't do it at all because they're intimidated by it, mm-hmm. or they just don't know how to just, like, move.
And that's why people feel... ashamed about not being able to orgasm, or people feel ashamed about not knowing how to connect with someone, and it's just like, well, but why should you just know how to do that? You don't just know how to do that. And then there comes a shame, like the overcoming the shame to admitting it, and then it's like, but then how do you learn? And I think that masturbation is key for any, like, sexual practices in that way. But I guess self-love is a better way of describing it, because masturbation's part of it. But again, you know, in this time I was, like, journaling a lot. I was doing a lot of, like, you know, personal, like, rituals and ceremony around myself and my spirit, as well as my sensuality. And, like, I made a point of, like, touching my whole body and understanding my whole self. And again, like, worshiping myself, really. Like, that's something that people could, I think many people would consider maybe indulgent or... whatever, but for me it was a really, really important part of accepting myself and learning about myself. And then because I took all that time and space, I had that energy to just create something that was, you know, a force of nature, which is what I believe Ruby Jones actually is. She is, like, all my will, just literally, like, bam, like, in all the bling in the world, just, like, really focused. You know, even I'm not as maybe as confident as her sometimes, or as sure, whereas Ruby, because of where she comes from in me, is just like a laser beam.
Yeah.
Or like a tornado. I don't know which one.
Yeah.
A combination, a laser tornado.
That would be so cool. But you wouldn't be able to live like that all the time, because the energy involved in creating
and drawing that out
of yourself is so much.
Yeah, and I went through a dark period of time where I think in persona specifically, everyone goes through a period of understanding where does the persona end and where do, like, obviously you never end, but where does the persona begin and end? And I think different artists run into different kind of growth periods of understanding that. And some of us, I'm not the only, like, because I've talked to other people about it, we go through periods of maybe living our lives too much as our persona. I lived too much as Ruby Jones for a little while, and it was only like maybe 6 months to a year, but that was enough time to almost derail everything that I had created for myself, as Ruby Jones. That was a period of really a huge shift and a lot of darkness. And, you know, I was very lucky to come out on the other side of it. But it's only in hindsight now that I know it's because I was trying to live my life and make decisions as Ruby Jones. Ruby Jones cannot make love to anyone. Ruby Jones cannot fall in love with anyone. Ruby Jones can't pay bills. Ruby Jones can't, you know, kind of keep me healthy. And that's because Ruby Jones is not all of me. It is a part of me, and it is something that I think a few of us, some of us, make the, I wouldn't say mistake, because it was something I really learned a lot from, but have made the choice that isn't maybe the best one, of kind of leading their life too much by persona or character or the energy of which we present on stage and in production and in creativity. And I think that happens to people, almost every persona-based artist, to some degree or another. Coming out the other side of the kind of darkest part of that dark period, it was still a bit dark at the beginning of the same Ruby Jones review, but that was me like actively trying to say that in my work and present that. It wasn't as refined as it is now, and it didn't have the same depth because I was still going through all of it. It was just the space of, and also the publicly, the branding of Save Ruby Jones, which is really strange and interesting at the same time, I think.
It's really cool though. So that's when you've, like, Ruby Jones has started to become an entity that you're comfortable living with, to the point where you became uncomfortable living too much as her again. But, like, you said you started going to cabaret and started seeing this around the same time. What do you remember your first ever cabaret show that you saw, and, like, what motivated you to go see it?
Okay, so basically I lived in East London, and a girl moved in with me who was really into vintage stuff, and she was studying with Joe King. I'm not going to say her name because I don't have her permission. But she was studying with Joe King, and she was really into vintage stuff, which was, and erotica stuff, which got her into burlesque. But she wasn't a performer at all.
Was that partially, was that around the same time that you were being curious about the sort of erotic side of things, or was it before?
I was already kind of in that kind of thing, and, like, had the blog going a little bit, and I wasn't telling anyone. So, yeah, the synchronicity was all kind of, like, you know, weaving like very nicely.
Energy was attracting someone with a similar sort of vibe.
Yeah, I'm really lucky. Like, the universe and I have a good conversation, basically. In that way, I'm very lucky to be, you know, open to it.
Okay, universe, I need this right now.
I need this right now.
Bring it.
Bring it. Exactly. So, it brought her, and she moved in, and she was studying with Joe King. But again, she had no performance background. She's like, I have to do my act, I don't know what to do. And I was like,
well, I've got 12 years of professional dance experience if you want.
So she gave me, like, her sheet of, like, what is a bump, what is a grind, what is this. And I was like, okay, and crumple and throw over my shoulder, and this is what we're gonna do. So I helped her to create her first routine, and so then I would go with her to shows. So I think one of the first ones I would have seen was the Tournament of Tees, which is actually where I made my burlesque debut.
Oh, cool.
So the Tournament of Tees used to happen at Bethnal Green Working Men's Club, and was really amazing, hosted by Joe King, had a panel of industry experts who would give you feedback after your performance. And then they did, like, say, 10 rounds a year.
That sounds like a lot of pressure.
Yeah, it was great, though. I would love to bring Tournament of Tees back.
Well, for someone like you who, like, is used to people being like, do this, do that.
You're horrible.
Okay.
Your turnout is appalling. Exactly. You need to work on that. Okay. Stretch harder. Yeah. Whereas for people who don't have that experience, I'm sure they would find them very intimidating.
Yeah, definitely. And so, like, kudos to everyone who gets into the industry, because there are lots of girls, especially in burlesque, who don't have performance background. It's like, wow, that must be harsh. But this was particularly, it wasn't harsh because everyone was lovely, but I think they actually gave real feedback as far as, like, some competitions you see now. They're like, I just loved the color of your wig and good job. Keep going. And I'm like, shut the F up. Like, you're not helping. You're not helping anyone here. Like, coddling does not help. Be like, wow, I love the color of that. You need to take some dance classes. Really maybe focus on this. Well done that. Like, it's not too hard, but people just don't want it. Like, people are like, but I'll be a bitch. I'm like, the only reason you think you're going to be a bitch is because you're a woman. So, like, let's just stop that right now. Like, really annoying. Nice. Yeah, exactly. Also,
I mean, have you heard of the critique sandwich? Nice thing, bad thing, nice thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And then the bad thing doesn't feel so bad because you've got double the nice things.
Yeah, and really exactly. Not hard. Exactly. And also, it's not like the bad thing has to be like, and I hate everything about you, and you know, it's like
you can frame it in a way that's good.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Something like include a reasoning, include a suggestion. Like a critique can be constructive. Like, it's not just like a put down. But I think in burlesque, people feel worried about because it's women or they're vulnerable or whatever. And I'm just like, actually, we're super powerhouses who created this earth, so fuck off. Like, we can handle it.
We create life inside us, then we have to push it out.
Exactly.
Come on now.
I think we can handle a little bit of a compliment sandwich kind of thing. So, yeah, totally agree. So, yeah, I started going like, you know, I could do that. And it was also a thing of, I started to get irked by people being like, the host being like, she's the most radiant burlesque dancer. And then as a dancer, I would see these little things and be like, she hasn't taken a dance class in her life. Or she has, she needs to go back. Because it would be like, you know, lines would be broken or toes wouldn't be pointed. Or there was no consideration of a lot of things that I just thought were kind of like, you know, not no-brainers. But I realized, okay, well, this person has no training. And then I was like, well, I'd like to try it, but I don't think I want to do it. So what do I do? And Tournament of Tees was having its very final round ever, and they were stopping the competition. Because basically there was like winners each month, and they all competed at the end, similar to Burlesque Idol. And so they were having their final one, and I thought, well, I don't want to do this professionally necessarily. So I don't want the pressure of having to build something and then like get a gig. So I'm just going to give it a go, basically. And so it was at the Bethel Green Working Men's Club, and Dirty Martini was the guest performer. Literally. I was just like, gag! And that day was such a magical one. I had my first piece of erotica reposted on Fleshbot. So I had, like, a piece of my writing was, like, published on Fleshbot.
Yeah,
huge, and like it was amazing. And then it was like that happened the morning of Tournament of Tees.
Ooh, good omens.
Yeah, really good. I was like, yeah, okay, I'm listening. So then I did Tournament of Tees, and I did not win. I got like honorable mention, like third place or whatever, like that, which was cool and fine. But I was nominated for an erotic award for Performer of the Year. And I was offered a role in the Off West End show, or Ish West End, depends who you ask, show, Burlesque. And that was from my first performance. So again, I was like, I'm listening. But I still wasn't totally sure. But yeah, I did this, which is like my signature act, like a sing and fling, where I sing I Want to Be Loved by You, but I never say loved. I like incorporate different things. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny to like think about that first performance. Because it was so timid.
Yeah.
Compared to where I am now.
Yeah.
Like, I think for a lot of people, it was still, because I was insinuating quite a lot in it, even then, that's what the response was. And because I was using humor, that was, like, I think one of the greatest attractions to what I did that night as well. And because I was singing, I was acting, and I did some striptease, and I was very naked. Shocker. Someone said to me, those were the smallest pasties and merkin I've ever seen in my life. They literally were the smallest ever. I bought them off eBay. It was like 10 quid, this like sequin heart or whatever. But whatever.
Oh my god.
Yeah, as you do, right, when you're first starting.
So tiny.
But yeah, that was the start, and
I guess this was towards the beginning of the sort of burlesque explosion that seems to have happened. So, you know, like now there's been such a proliferation of burlesque.
Yeah.
It's like
everywhere.
It's and if crazy. You want to do a burlesque gig for free,
yeah,
you can definitely find one. But it, like you said, it feels very much more geared towards the more like, you know, classic.
Yeah, classic, neoclassic, kind of. It still has commercial standards in a way. Like, I make money in cabaret, but I make most of my money as a host. I would say the other side of it, a lot of my money comes from working in, like, fetish or erotica, which is, like, more performance arty. Obviously has burlesque and cabaret elements, but it's also very much in, like, a kind of, like, I can't do those acts everywhere, basically. Yeah. Like, I do them at Torture Garden or at The Box or, you know, those kinds of places. But then where do I fit into the other side of it? And I've had some thoughts about that. Like, because I do have all this dance training, I definitely use it in my work now. But I will probably do, like, a burlesque routine next year. Just because I feel like there's a thing of, like, oh, Ruby Jones, she only does that because she can't do this. And I'm like, oh, really? Really? Okay.
Bust out your most commercially, sparkly, showgirly side.
Exactly.
Just to prove them all wrong.
Well, yeah, and just it. To also prove myself right.
Yeah,
yeah, sure. More so, like, oh, actually, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That is a thing. Because I do love burlesque. It's very important to me. Because I talk to so many people, and so many educated and so many uneducated people who just think burlesque is limited, and I just don't think it is. I don't think it's limited. I understand that the market is limited, i.e. if I want to do certain shows, like, I'm going to have to, like, get a wig and, like, maybe not reference fisting in my singing playing. Fine, whatever. Everyone loves it. But they don't even know what they want. I mean, audiences sometimes.
Yeah.
They're like, like, what's going to happen?
I feel like at the moment, and maybe this is a recent thing, or maybe it's always been this way because of the nature of the cabaret industry, it's almost like when you present yourself as a performer, people see you as this one thing, and it's immutable, and that's all that you do, and it's almost like, oh, I'm booking you based on this.
Yeah.
You can't adapt it. And it's like, if you're a good performer, you understand what the client wants.
Yes.
You change it up. If you're a great performer, you give them a great show.
Exactly.
But it feels like in cabaret, people are like, oh, you do this one thing. I guess you can't do this. Never mind, I'll book someone else.
Yeah, and it's like, oh, I could do that.
Yeah.
And, like, it's weird, like, comparing, I think I get away with it that bit more. I think that audiences, like, are up for a lot more. It's just about how you present it to them. And I'm looking forward to kind of pushing my burlesque more next year. Save Ruby Jones Review has now become Save Ruby Jones, the show. And I'm actually only doing 4 of those shows next year rather than a monthly thing. And part of that is because I really want to put some focus back on myself as a solo performer.
I think, yeah, people get really limited by their personal brand.
Yes.
And it's really nice to see people, because you're still you, you're still performing.
Yeah.
So whatever you do is going to have that essence of you.
Yeah.
And it's totally okay to, like, if it's come out of your brain, it's going to be an expression of yourself as a performer.
Exactly.
It's going to be great.
Exactly.
So, you know, it's nice to hear people who you think have a very specific niche being like, no, I don't. Yeah. I'm everything.
Yeah.
I'm everywhere.
Exactly.
I will do everything.
I'm literally everywhere.
I will invade every corner of this world.
I really will. I will not rest. And then I will rest for 100 years.
Yeah, you can rest when you're dead.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, honestly, I'm in this for understanding. I'm in this for developing work which challenges myself and the audience.
So, before I turned on the microphone, because you mentioned Save Ruby Jones Review, it seems like you've been doing a lot of producing in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Like, tons of shows.
Well, a monthly show is not a easy feat.
No.
Like, OMG. Like, I can't even believe, now that I have the prospect of only doing one every 3 or 4 months, I'm like, weird, what am I gonna do? And I've been producing the Save Ruby Jones Review, now Save Ruby Jones, for over 2 years. It started in, I want to say, May of 2012. And it started officially, so I had, I think, maybe a show in the April, But it started for me with the my first themed show, which was There's No Wedding Party, Wedding Party. And it was a wedding-themed show, and performers were Lolo Brow, Miss Cairo, then Mr. Mistress, Hot Cake Kitty, I can't remember, a few other people. Sorry, people, I'm not remembering. That was the first as well where I started to consider narrative, more overall narrative of the show. A lot of cabaret shows, even with themes, will just, everything just fits the theme. Mm-hmm. Whereas I had the idea of, at the beginning of the show, I went around and was like, oh, Cousin Jack, thanks so much for coming. I hope you ordered the chicken. It's going to be absolutely delicious. And like kind of had this theater base for it.
Yeah.
And then also kind of, oh, Aurora Galore was in that show. How could I forget? And then basically the last like section of the show, Mr. Mistress did his act to Gay Messiah, where he has got this amazing like, yeah, gay messiah moment, mm-hmm. and this like priest type character with this like crown of cocks that like squirts like juice, and he like, yeah, all this like amazing archetypal stuff like mixed in with like queer satire and activism. And after he finished his piece, he married me to myself on stage. And I took vows and I married myself. And then Aurora did Marry the Night by good old Gaga. And did, like, proper, like, ruckus fire thing. Just ended on a high note, but also to, like, you know, kind of cement that commitment. And the show's really evolved now into the story of Ruby Jones, of things I am, Ruby Jones, is considering, is understanding. I've got a one-woman show called Ruby Jones Learns. And it's like, I will always have like a theme. So it's like Ruby Jones learns about shamelessness or the body or sex or whatever. And now I feel like Save Ruby Jones, the show, is like a mashing of the Save Ruby Jones Review and Ruby Jones Learns. Like that kind of intensity has been like pushed and stays in the cabaret. So it's still got a cabaret format, but I call it Cabba Theater. Because I'm just like, what is this thing? It doesn't feel like cabaret in the same way to me anymore.
Yeah.
It is, but it isn't. And it's because it includes me more now. Me in thought, in narrative, as a host. I make a point of always doing, not just because I used to like bash out songs, but now I do tend to do a new act for each month.
Yeah.
And, you know, the show we have coming up on the 19th of November is Feast. Because one of our most infamous shows at Finsbury Park was the food show. Super messy, super gross, super fun.
But the cleanup was good for that one.
Oh my god, you have no idea. We had a swimming pool, like a paddling pool that Lily Snatchdragon did her English breakfast act in, which is legendary.
Yeah.
So it was like full of English breakfast stuff. And then we like took it in the men's loo, which was right next to the stage, but somehow it got forgotten and it was like literally in the loo for like a week or something.
Just a paddling pool full of English breakfast ingredients.
Yeah, just like molting and like rotting in the corner, like it's just so But like this month, this time around, you know, I'm gonna address, as I have in my blog in the past, like eating disorders, body dysmorphia, the kind of understanding of food and feeding self and of body and relationship and the disconnection. And it's gonna finished with like a crazy spectacular splosh by the infamous Boom Boom.
Amazing.
Which is gonna be amazing. But also the rest of the time I incorporate the performers, whether that is because I create pieces with them for the show, or you know, adapt one of their current pieces, or one of their pieces fits perfectly. It's about telling stories, it's about really addressing the themes in a way that has like a kind of overall flow. It's been a really slow evolution. I really do think slow and steady wins the race, and I know we all feel like so much pressure, like I need to do this now and I need to create this now and I need to be here now, and it's like, actually, maybe just know what you want first.
Yeah.
And then slowly work towards it in like a focused fashion.
For sure.
Yeah. And the RVT, moving to the Royal Vauxhall Tavern, gave me so much space to do that.
Yeah.
Because like, and it's like, for me really in London, it's my performance home. It's where I've done most of my performance, whether that's through Whatever World, which is like a regular Tuesday night kind of queer cabaret, or, you know, I do burlesque there, or any number of things. Like, it's where I've done my most of my work. And in they have the Hot August Fringe at the RVT every August.
Yeah.
And 2 years in a row, I had residency where I did every single week. I did, I developed my one woman show, and that's how I've come to be able to have this development of Save Ruby Jones, the show. And it was the space of being in the RBT that gave me that freedom.
The more I talk to performers, especially ones that have their own shows or like ones that are really exciting and different, mm-hmm. the more I see the pattern of, and then I did a one woman show. Yeah. And I learned all the things about myself.
Yeah, and definitely like how Save Ruby Jones works as well is like, because I'm on a Wednesday and I'm basically planning to be like very transparent about this in the near future. Like, I do not pay any of my performers money. My money that I make on the door just covers my sound person, my stage person, my door person, and rider for my performers. I usually, every month, and a photographer usually, then every month I usually end up paying for some artist expenses and a videographer. That is out of my own money. Luckily, I have a day job, so that's not so bad. But because of that, and because I don't want to feel the pressure of that, like thinking like, oh God, I need to get people in so I can pay people, I offer performers outright my time. It is based on a swap. And I will do, depending on who the performer is, you get anywhere from 1 to 4 hours with me. And my time is, you know, a minimum of £40 an hour. So if you're a newbie, you might only get 1 hour with me. But then, therefore, that was you getting paid £40 for that show.
Yeah.
But also, I do prep work with people before the show so that their acts fit into my show or so that their acts can be stronger for the show. And that is the exchange that I work on with my show.
Yeah.
And that works for me. And I'm really excited to see how that works in the future. And, like, I've been, like, in some ways, like, really humbled as to who's been like, that's great. I'd love some of your time. That's a great exchange. I'm like, oh, God, okay. Excellent. Because I felt like, you know, a cad even suggesting it to, you know, you, Marty Scarlett, or you, you know, whoever, like, these people who I super respect, you know, realizing, like, they see the value in that exchange. That has been really amazing, but also that means, like, every month, that's, like, what, a minimum of, like, 10 hours of my time and, like, renting studios and all that stuff. So next year, when I don't have this show every month, I'm going to be able to really do that in a fashion where there's no resentment on any side. It is a very even exchange. It's something that will push both artists, i.e. myself and whoever I'm working with. And I just think there's a lot of space in cabaret for that kind of, like, development. People don't have the chance to work with other people very much. Lots of people don't have extra money, so they couldn't necessarily hire me to help them with their burlesque routine. But then there's other people who might be like, oh, well then, yeah, I'll do that one performance if mm-hmm. I have 3 hours of your time.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, no problem. Like, for sure. Like, an exchange I'm totally happy with.
So, oh God, I have so many more questions for you. Maybe you should do, like a family fierce, like, group podcast
at some point. Yeah, that'd be awesome.
That'd be so fun to just have all of you sit down and, like, talk about a topic that you're all interested in.
Yeah, definitely.
Because there's so much more I want to talk to you about, like, about addiction, about, like, the queer side of things, and mm-hmm. how you came to that, and, like, oh, I feel like we barely scratched the surface. There's so much to Ruby Jones. There's so much depth here. I just want to, like, mine it. This should be, like, a 4-hour podcast. But then, like, we'd
part
never get...
Part 6 of Ruby Jones.
Yeah, we'd never get anywhere from. And also, people can come and see what you're about. So... Yeah,
definitely.
To wrap up...
Yes.
Yeah. What is the best thing that's happened to you on stage, and what is the worst thing that's happened to you on stage?
To be honest, I feel like, in a way... Okay, I'll answer the worst thing first, because I always say that. I don't think that there's any, like, there isn't anything bad that happens on stage, because it's like a safe space in that way, because you can, it's about what you make of it, and it's about how you handle it, and how you receive it, and, like, yeah, I've fallen on stage when I wasn't supposed to fall, or my tops got caught in my earrings, or, you know, whatever has happened, or, like, oh my God, is my tampon string hanging out? I'm not sure. I can't do anything about it. Like, those things happen, but it always has made me feel stronger as a performer, has always made me feel the rush of what cabaret is for me, of that thing being different every time. I can't think, unfortunately, for, like, laugh's sake, of, like, the worst thing that's happened to me on stage, because for me, the stage is such a safe space. There isn't anything that goes wrong, per se. Like, there's things that don't go right.
So funny.
But, you know, they just...
So many people see the stage as the scariest place in the world, and you're like, it's my home,
it's my best. Home, it's a safe space for me. It's like, oh, I'm on stage, I can breathe now. Like, so for the best, I love performing at shows where I'm actually like, oh God, I'm in, like, Basingstoke, and what the hell are they going to make of me? And then at the end, like, having everyone be in love with me and me being in love with all of them, and this amazing, like, love-in of actually, like, we're all just humans and we just love each other. Like, it always, luckily, comes back around like that for me. Standing ovations don't mark your career. Like, standing ovations are great and cool, but, like, that wouldn't be a highlight for me. The highlight for me would be, like, winning over, like, a rural, like, pub. Basically.
Proper old man pub.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's such a positive way of looking at performance on the stage. Where can people find you? What kind of shows you got coming up? If, you know, listeners have been super inspired by this podcast, which they should have been, where cool. can they find all the great things that you're doing?
All right. Well, I am the only Ruby Jones with three Ys, so you can find me on... I know. I found one Ruby with three Ys, just not Jones, on Facebook, and I was like, I'm sending you a cease and desist. Do not even do this. But she's like a South American acoustic musician, so I think I'll let it go for a little bit. But yeah, you can find me on Instagram and Twitter under that handle, Ruby3WiseJones. And that's Jones with all the normal letters. And on Facebook. But this month, you can catch me in my final show at the RVT of the year, which is November 19th. That is the Feast show, and doors are at 7:30. Amazing lineup, Bambi Blue, the infamous Boom Boom, Fagulous, amongst other people. Yeah. And then I've got three shows actually, at the Mimetic Festival. The first one is with Marcus Reeves, which is actually happening on the 26th. Which is a Wednesday, and we're going Behind the Mask, which is his chat show. We're doing like live performance mixed with his chat show, which will be super cool. It's also Benjamin Luce, Champagne Charlie, and Tricity Vogue are doing his series. Yeah, Marcus Reeves, hashtag Behind the Mask. And then I've got my two shows at the Mimetic Festival on November 27th, which is the Death Show, which is one that we have done in the past, but I'm bringing back lots of ritual, lots of absolution, going over to the other side. That's at 10 p.m. And then I've got my first showcase of my students, which are called Young Feminist Whores, and that's on the 29th at 10 p.m. at the Mimetic Festival as well.
Wow. Yeah. So much. And if people want to look at your website,
it's rubyjones.com. My blog's rubyjones.com/theblog. And yeah, if you find me on Facebook, I'm like definitely always sending stuff to Facebook. Yeah, Twitter is Ruby Jones also. Same with awesome. Instagram.
Amazing.
Yeah.
You are like, you're one of the queens of social media. I will say that.
I love it. It's a good game.
It's like you and Aurora Galore as well. Like the two of you. I'm just like, wow, social media. You're like on it. You are on it all the time.
Yes, it's an investment of time.
Thank yeah. you. Yeah. Thank you so much for talking with me today.
Yeah, thank you.
Fascinating and educational and exciting. Yay. And I want to do a part two like right now.
Yay!
Listeners, thank you again. I've been your host, Rosie Cole. You can find me on social media. You can find me on Facebook/RosieColeDancer. You can find me on Twitter @Rosie_Cole. You can find me on my email. You can email me. I love getting comments. If you have any opinions about anything, doesn't necessarily have to be with cabaret, like people you'd like to see, mm-hmm. anything at all. I just talk to me.
Talk to her people.
You can email
She's
me.
It's great to chat to.
On rosiecoledancer@gmail.com, or you can have a look at my website, rosiecole.com. And audience, as performance, we would be absolutely nothing without you. So thank you so much for listening.
Thank you,
and have a great day.
Bye.